From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the White House confirms the beheading of an American held by the Islamic State. A stock market link opens between Shanghai and Hong Kong.
I do think that it's right to sort of make a big deal out of it, but on the other hand, the immediate impact of the scheme is not likely to be that big.
And experts say the Western diet is bad for health and the environment. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. The White House Sunday confirmed the beheading of American aid worker Abdul Rahman Kasig, formerly known as Peter Kasig, the third American to be decapitated in Syria by Islamic State militants. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the latest execution occurred as the top U.S. military official met with senior Iraqi and Kurdish officials, and the U.S. began advising and training Iraqi security forces in restive western Anbar province.
In a statement, President Barack Obama offered prayers and condolences to the parents and family of Kasig, whose life, quote, was taken from us in an act of pure evil by a terrorist group that the world rightly associates with inhumanity. The White House said, while IS revels in the slaughter of innocents, Kasig was a humanitarian who worked to save the lives of Syrians injured and dispossessed by the Syrian conflict. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who lauds Kasig for his service as an Army Ranger in Iraq, says he was a humanitarian who sought to ease the suffering of others.
I think the fact that he went back to help the people that he saw that needed help says everything about who he was and what he believed. There are people who have extraordinary values and principles in their lives, like Peter Kasig did, and he applied that, and it cost him his life.
The 26-year-old Kasig, who witnessed the suffering of the Syrian people while visiting the region as a college student in 2012, was captured in eastern Syria in October 2013 while delivering relief supplies for the aid group he founded. He is the fifth Westerner beheaded by IS. The militant Sunni group executed American journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff and British aid workers David Haynes and Alan Henning. Kasig's parents, Ed and Paula of Indianapolis, Indiana, who pleaded in a video last month to IS to spare their son's life, said they were heartbroken by the news. Appearing Sunday on U.S. television, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel stands with the U.S. in the battle against IS.
We support President Obama in leading this coalition. It has to be fought, ISIS. It has to be defeated, and it can be defeated.
The Israeli leader says the Middle East is awash in militant Islamists, Sunni and Shia, and in a reference to Iran's nuclear ambitions, says they must not be allowed to acquire weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. is stepping up its training and advising mission of Iraqi forces battling IS fighters, with plans to train up to 12 brigades, including 9 Iraqi units and 3 comprised of Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. The top U.S. military official, General Martin Dempsey, met with Iraqi Kurdish officials Sunday in Erbil after holding talks in Baghdad with members of Iraq's central government. RAND Corporation senior political scientist Rick Brennan, a career army officer, says he believes Dempsey is carrying two messages.
One is that the United States is here to provide the type of assistance that the Iraqi security forces need in order to develop capabilities that have atrophied over the last several years. The other message I think he's trying to emphasize is a great need for the Shia-led government to reach out and mend bridges with the Sunni populace. If you go back to the 2006, 5 and 6 time period, one of the great successes that the United States military had was driving a wedge between the Sunni populace and the predecessor of ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Brennan says U.S. forces now operating in Anbar province hope to reestablish that wedge lost during the tenure of former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He says their presence at Ain al-Assad Air Base is significant. He says it was envisioned as a training facility had U.S. forces been allowed to stay past 2011. Although U.S. troops were withdrawn, he expects the base to allow the more rapid training of Iraqi security forces. Following the announcement earlier this month that President Obama was authorizing deployment of another 1,500 U.S. troops to Iraq, Brennan says the Obama administration is finally taking actions that should have been implemented months ago. He says the fight against IS will take more U.S. forces than are currently on the ground. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, France says one of its citizens is among the Islamic State militants appearing in a video announcing the beheading of American aid worker Abdulrahman Kassig. Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve identified the Frenchman today as 22-year-old Maxime Hachar, who left for Syria more than a year ago after a brief stay in Mauritania. Officials are trying to determine if a second French national was among the 16 jihadists in the video, which shows Kassig's severed head and the beheadings of at least 18 Syrian soldiers. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's first state visit to neighboring Pakistan over the weekend has generated an unusual level of optimism on both sides of the border, with some hailing it as the beginning of a new era in the often acrimonious bilateral relationship. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
President Ghani spent a busy time during his two-day stay in Pakistan, where he held detailed discussions with Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and other political leaders. But the high point of his engagements was a visit to the headquarters of the powerful Pakistan military that many Afghans accuse of fueling the conflict in their country. Former ambassador to the United States, Sheri Rehman, was among the Pakistani politicians who met with Mr. Ghani on the sidelines of his visit. Speaking to VOA, she said that the Afghan leader seemed determined to set the tone for ending tensions in bilateral relations.
It was a clear effort by the new leadership to reach across the board very positively and engage in a constructive, forward-looking agenda with a clear realization of the problems that we have, the bilateral relationship has faced in the recent and other past. So I think the idea of leaving it behind and leveraging our potential, both for trade as well as a people-to-people integration as a South Asian energy hub, can only be realized if we are able to solve our counterterrorism and strategic problems. And I do see the political will, at least, on both sides to overcome that.
Speaking to VOA by phone from Kabul, Afghan politician and a close aide of President Ghani, Professor Farooq Azam, also sounded optimistic the visit will go a long way toward building much-needed mutual trust.
I think this is a new era, and President Ghani is man of development, man of economic prosperity vision, has put forward a new thesis that instead of being in confrontation mode, let us be in cooperation mode and find the ways how we can benefit the conditions to the benefit of our people.
Professor Azam is cautiously optimistic about President Ghani's trip to Pakistan's military headquarters in Rawalpindi and talks with Army Chief General Raheel Sharif.
This is a significant gesture in the part of Pakistan as well, that Pakistan showed to the President Ghani that the military headquarters is open to him. And Ghani also probably has thought that the military in Pakistan is deciding matters, not the civilian government. So that is a good gesture, and I think they can go forward. But the thing is whether practically we can put it in that way, if we can in practice to work together.
Ambassador Rehman disagreed with criticism that the Pakistan military dictates Afghan policy to the country's civilian rulers. She says that direct interactions between relevant institutions on both sides of the border would help ease tensions because challenges in bilateral relations mainly stem from differences over counterterrorism policies.
I think it's a good move, and I think the whole business of coercive diplomacy through the media from all sides has to stop. Public messaging is not the way to conduct diplomacy. You send each other a message if you're looking to solve a problem, and I think that is the way forward. And I think they have, Pakistan under President Ghani, have signaled their interest in taking that kind of positive initiative. So I would really look towards the future and building on whatever little gains we can make right now.
Former President Hamid Karzai used to frequently accuse the Pakistan military of allowing Afghan insurgents to direct the Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan, and insisted Islamabad could influence the Islamist group to come to the table for talks with the Afghan government. While critics are unsure whether Pakistan can persuade the Taliban to become part of Afghan political reconciliation efforts, Professor Azam calls for the new Afghan leadership in Kabul to urgently devise its own peace plans before seeking external help.
To a large extent, peace depends on Afghanistan itself. And this is the job of the government of Afghanistan, that first to clear itself that whether the government of Afghanistan wants peace, and if yes, then what kind of peace they want. And they must come out with clear definition and clear mechanism and give way to a reconciliation in order to move forward practically. And then they can go to other countries to ask help.
The United States also believes that despite deep-rooted challenges, Pakistan and Afghanistan under President Ghani seem determined to have a fresh start in their bilateral relations. U.S. Special Representative for both the countries, Dan Feldman, expressed these views while speaking to VOA on the eve of Mr. Ghani's landmark trip to Islamabad.
This is the most alignment that I've seen in terms of the opportunity to start this new chapter in the relationship. And I think there's so many areas of potential progress here on cross-border military issues, on counterterrorism issues. There's many, many things that could be great dividends for the people of Pakistan and the people of Afghanistan if the two countries can work together better. And we see every indication that that's possible, given the commitment and desire both by Pakistani leadership and by Afghan leadership.
Analysts hope that President Ghani's visit to Islamabad will lead to enhanced security cooperation between the two countries and better management of their long and porous border to prevent militants from seeking sanctuaries and fueling militancy in both countries. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Somalia's political crisis is growing, with 14 ministers asking the prime minister to resign due to his intense political rift with the president. The standoff between the two men has paralyzed the government for the last couple of months. Abdulaziz Bilo has more on the story from Mogadishu.
More than half of Somali cabinet ministers have joined calls seeking the immediate resignation of Prime Minister Abdiweli Sheikh Ahmed to end the political stalemate with the president. At issues are disagreements over political appointments, which has also divided parliament. In the past week, lawmakers failed twice to bring a no-confidence motion in the prime minister to a vote in what turned into a raucous session where debate had to be suspended. MP Abdurrahman Hosh Jibril says a small number of lawmakers should not be able to disrupt the work of parliament. He says it is unacceptable for 40 MPs to disrupt a session where more than 220 MPs are meeting. He says if the Speaker of Parliament is unable to handle the House, then as MPs they will seek his resignation. Meanwhile, lawmakers from both camps have been meeting in Mogadishu hotels on ways to break the impasse. MP Abdi Barre, who supports the Prime Minister, insists that the no-confidence motion is unconstitutional and his colleagues will block the vote at all costs. He says we are blocking the motion because it was politically motivated and never emanated from the floor of the House. Therefore, it is unconstitutional. It has been less than a year since lawmakers ousted Prime Minister Abdi Farah Shirton in a similar manner. Tension between President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud and the current Prime Minister has sparked international concern that Somalia could slide back into political turmoil, slowing progress towards stabilizing the war-torn country. The United Nations has led international efforts to create a stable central government in the country after more than two decades of violence and chaos and an insurgency by militant group Al-Shabaab. The UN Special Envoy to Somalia, Nicholas Kay, offered to help Somali leaders reach a mutually satisfactory compromise. He also expressed concern about reported vote buying in the political standoff and warned that any action by any party that creates political turmoil will be reported to the United Nations Security Council. President Mahmoud called on the international community to respect the sovereignty of Somalia, saying a Somali-led process is the only way to end the current political crisis. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. A trading link allowing Hong Kong and Shanghai investors to buy and sell limited shares on each other's exchanges debuted today in an effort to open China's capital markets. The Shanghai-Hong Kong Stock Connect platform gives many investors outside mainland China access to the stock market of the world's number two economy for the first time. And it gives Chinese investors access to a market outside of the mainland. Investors will be allowed to buy and sell a total of up to $3.8 billion of stock in a select list of companies each day. Xiao Gong, head of the China Securities Regulatory Commission, said the new platform is conducive to the internationalization of the renminbi. Julian Evans Pritchard, China economic analyst at the Singapore-based Capital Economics, tells VOA's Victor Beatty this will be a gradual process that involves a tiny amount of the market capitalization of each market.
Obviously, it is a major step towards opening up China's capital account. So I do think that it's right to sort of make a big deal out of it. But on the other hand, the immediate impact of the scheme is not likely to be that big. And that's partly because, you know, regulators are taking a very cautious approach, so limiting the quota to about 1% of the market capitalization of each market. It's going to be a very gradual process. So on the one hand, it's a big step in the right direction, but on the other hand, the immediate impact is going to be quite limited, so it's going to be more of a gradual reform and opening up process.
What are the benefits for Chinese equities?
So obviously, Chinese equity, you know, now they have a larger pool of international investors. It's more of its significance in terms of a step towards opening up the capital account rather than its impact on the Shanghai market. Probably the bigger impact is actually on the Hong Kong market, because obviously you have the dual-listed Chinese firms on each market, but the investors who invest through the scheme from Hong Kong, they're not allowed to short Shanghai stocks. And generally, Shanghai-listed firms have been trading at a premium to their listings in Hong Kong. So what we've seen as a result of the scheme is that the price of these shares in Hong Kong is increased, converged to their price in Shanghai, because obviously, you know, there are arbitrage opportunities once, you know, as the scheme comes into play. So, you know, in recent weeks, we've seen that convergence happen already pretty much. So the impact probably on the Hong Kong market has been bigger.
Is this part of the Chinese government's market reforms?
I think it is, and I think that's one reason why they've, you know, pushed ahead with the scheme, even though, you know, obviously they're not very happy about what's happening in Hong Kong with the protests. But I don't think it was in their interest. I know some people had talked about the possibility of the scheme being cancelled as a result of the Hong Kong protests as a kind of punishment, but I don't think that was in their interest, because it is in their interest as well to launch this scheme, not just in the interest of Hong Kong. For them, it's a very important step for opening up the capital account, but in a very controlled manner. Because of the way that they've built the scheme so that there's a limited cap on daily flows of only around 13 billion RMB, so it allows them to control the flows in between the countries and sort of prevent volatile capital flows, which is often the main concern when you open up the capital account, is that, you know, volatile capital flows can set off financial crises, and that's often happened after countries that didn't have mature enough financial systems but then pushed ahead with opening the capital account anyway, and a lot of them have experienced issues. So they're taking a very cautious approach, and this is a way for them to open up gradually but still keep control over the flows.
Julian Evans Pritchard says if the quota is filled, there may be an incentive to gradually raise the quota and perhaps open up the capital accounts to the already existing Shanghai Free Trade Zone. He says his firm is sticking with its overall 2014 China growth rate of 7.3% and expects fourth quarter growth to come in at 7.2%, following the third quarter's 7.3% rate. He expects lower growth rates in coming years, in part due to the resilient Chinese labor market. The globalization of Western eating habits is bad for human health and for the environment, according to a new study in the journal Nature. Dietary solutions to this diet health environment trilemma exist, but as VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, they will require a change in eating habits that are heavily influenced by culture, taste, price, and convenience.
In the study, David Tillman analyzed data from 100 countries to chart what people ate and how diet affected health. The University of Minnesota ecology professor noted a trend beginning in the 1960s as nations industrialized, populations increased, and incomes rose. More people began to adopt the so-called Western diet, one high in refined sugar, fat, oil, and meat. People began to get fatter and sicker.
The excess, let's say, in the 15 richest nations in the world right now is on the order of about 400 or 500 extra calories a day that are eaten beyond what people need, and that leads to people to gain weight.
And overweight people are at greater risk for non-communicable diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and some cancers.
Diabetes is shooting to very high rates in the United States and across Europe. Heart disease is a major cause of mortality in the Western countries. And unfortunately, when people become industrialized, if they adopt this Western diet, they're going to have these same health impacts. And in some cases, if you're Asian, actually have them more severely than even happens in the West.
China, he says, is a case in point where diabetes has skyrocketed.
From less than 1% to 10% of the population having diabetes as they began to industrialize over a 20-year period. And that hasn't leveled off yet. That's still going up. So, and that is happening all across the world, in Mexico and Nigeria and so on, just nation after nation.
And the diet bad for humans is also bad for the environment. As global population grows, experts say more forests and tropical habitats will be converted into farmland for crops or grazing pasture for cattle to meet the increased demand for food.
We're likely to have more greenhouse gas released in the future from agriculture because of this dietary shift than all the greenhouse gas that right now comes out of all of the cars and all the airplanes, boats, and ships, all forms of transportation. So our change in diet is likely to be worse for the world for climate warming than all the transportation sources we use right now.
Writing in the journal Nature, Tillman says the link between diet, the environment, and human health, what he calls a trilemma, is one of the greatest challenges facing humanity. One solution he presents is leaving the Western diet behind, something that Jacqueline Rogers and Mike Richmond know something about. The two VOA staffers have each lost 22 kilograms and kept off the weight. Rogers, who has a family history of diabetes, calls herself a reformed carboholic.
I ate lots of carbs all the time. That was my go-to. Pastas, rices, potatoes, breads. I never met any of those things in any form that I didn't like. I had to switch that around, become more vegetable-based, more fruit-based, more protein-based. That plus physical activity made the big difference for me.
Richmond says he was always athletic, but could not compete like he used to because he was overweight. He started to go to a gym, lift weights, and run on a treadmill. At the same time, he changed his diet.
It hasn't been anything as complicated as what Jackie's done. I mean, I've just cut out a lot of sweets, a lot of junk, and also just simple things like walking up the stairs and instead of taking the elevator. I always do that. I will not take the elevator at all.
So how do you feel now?
I feel great. I feel that I could probably, if I wanted to play basketball again, I could probably do the same things I did in my 20s and 30s.
My job is sedentary. I have to force myself to get up, go out, walk around the building, walk up the stairs, go to the fifth floor, come on back down. I have to make myself do something throughout the day, not just sit at the computer.
How do you feel?
I feel fantastic. I feel much better. I feel alive. I'm not sluggish. I feel like I can do anything I set my mind to.
Roger says the switch in lifestyle has been a matter of making better choices, choices that are better for her health and the health of the planet. And she adds she no longer has any sign of diabetes. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Well, congratulations to her. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events at our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.